From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Affordable Care Act needs healthy young people. Will enough of them sign up by the March 31st deadline?
Young adults are often procrastinators and don't feel the urgent need to get insurance as much as older adults might. So you do see a big surge in the numbers going on right as we approach the deadline.
As they wow the world at the Winter Olympics, we revisit a conversation with Michigan Ice dancers Charlie Davis and Merrill White.
I think Charlie and I thoroughly enjoy not only the competition aspect, but the practice aspect as well. We really enjoy kind of seeing our own growth and working really hard.
And a plea to stop ignoring Detroit's Wright Museum of African American History.
This is a museum that is used by people of all colors to learn and understand a really horrific part of American history.
Those stories and more today. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for joining us, and happy President's Day. According to the government, more than 1.1 million Americans signed up for health insurance through state and federal exchanges in January alone. That brings the total to nearly 3.3 million people. On today's show, we look at what's being done here in Michigan and across the country to sell more healthy young people on the new health care law before the upcoming March 31st deadline. And then we explore whether the Charles H. Wright Museum in Detroit can stay alive, even as other problems in the Motor City are being addressed with dollars and with effort. But first, over the weekend, Michigan Republicans chose a new member of the Republican National Committee to take the seat vacated when Terry Lynn Land stepped down to run for Carl Levin's Senate seat. The new member is someone with quite a Michigan political pedigree. Ronna Romney McDaniel is Mitt Romney's niece and, of course, the granddaughter of Michigan's 43rd governor, George Romney. Just what does her election mean for Michigan's profile on the Republican National Committee? We're joined now by Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Hello, Rick.
Hello, Cindy. Happy President's Day.
That's right. Happy President's Day indeed. And apart from her celebrated uncle who wanted to be president and her grandfather who also wanted to be president, tell us just who is Ronna Romney McDaniel.
Well, actually, she is, as you pointed out, a member of the Romney family, which has a long political history in Michigan. And she kind of emerged as an interesting character during the presidential campaign when she took on a semi-prominent role in the state in her uncle's presidential campaign. And she turned out to, be pretty articulate, have some charisma. And so Republican officials were kind of looking for something for her to do, to, put her out there in the public eye a little bit more. And this seemed like the opportunity. We should also point out that her mother, Ronna Romney, who at the time was married to Scott Romney, was a Republican National Committee woman and one
that.
Who at one point in her career fended off a challenge from the same Terry Land, who is now running for the Senate.
Okay. And she got up there and in her victory speech, Ronna Romney McDaniel talked about the need for party unity. Tell us more of what she said and were they listening?
This is obviously a veiled reference to the Dave Ajima controversies,
yes.
The anti-gay, anti-Muslim National Committee man. Every state has three members of the Republican National Committee, a committee man, a committee woman, and the state party chair. It's been that way since the 1920s. And Mr. Ajima, former state lawmaker, sort of has a history of expressing his views in a rather incendiary fashion. Both in his speeches and in various social media postings. And the idea here was that, there were a couple of Tea Party Republicans who were also vying for the position. And Ronna Romney was considered kind of a safe establishment choice and maybe someone who would just tamp down some of that controversy and try to, one, bind the wounds of the party and also have a presence that's more publicly comfortable than what we've seen coming out of Mr. Ajima of late. Although we should point out that, this meeting of the state Republican Party Executive Committee that selected Ms. Romney McDaniel to be on the national committee wasn't an entirely comfortable affair, that there were censure resolutions percolating against both Mr. Ajima for the things that he's said and also against Bobby Shostak, the current state Republican Party chair, for not being accommodating enough of Tea Party views. And so, the Michigan Republican Party is still, rent with a bit of, division and controversy right now. And party leaders are hoping that maybe the selection of Ronna Romney McDaniel will be a step toward getting off that path.
I noted headlines on this weekend in both the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press stories about how Terry Lynn Land, who, of course, stepped down from the RNC to run for Carl Levin's Senate seat, her campaign has been building ahead of steam. I mean, she was behind, but she's basically now seen as neck and neck with Democrat Gary Peters, which I guess must have been a topic of interest to the folks who were gathered there Saturday.
Well, it's really the reason why she stepped down, that, up until now, she'd said that, for the time being, at least after the primary, that she could comfortably serve in both the National Committee Woman position as well as being a candidate for the U.S. Senate. But the association with Mr. Ajima was just, also on the RNC, was just becoming a bit too problematic, a bit too much of a hot seat. And so the decision was made that probably it would be better for a campaign that's turning out to be pretty darn credible at this juncture.
Rick, why do people think that is turning into a pretty darn credible campaign?
Well, the conventional wisdom in Michigan is that for these federal seats, at least, Democrats have a pretty substantial built-in advantage. And as it turns out, with early fundraising and early poll raising, that Terry Lynn Land is turning out to seem like a pretty credible candidate for the seat. I mean, we should point out that the polling is still early, and there's a lot that can happen. But you work with what right now.
Now, and as Republicans gathered, and besides choosing their new committee member, Ronna Romney McDaniel, what kind of strategy was talked about looking ahead to this fall? What are Republicans saying they need to do to prove that they are not paralyzed by the intra-party divisions? And as you said, some of that was rearing its head as they were together on Saturday.
Well, I think the number one thing that they have to do, and this was acknowledged, is, get past this controversy, that it wasn't stated outright, but, Mr. Ajima needs to remain quiet, or at least express his views in, in less of a, missile launch fashion, and, really focus on securing the base in order to be competitive, going into the summer and the November election.
Michigan Public Radio Network, Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. As always, a pleasure. Thank you, Rick.
My pleasure as well, Cindy.
Has Michigan managed to stop the hemorrhage of folks packing up and moving out? The recently released migration study from United Van Lines would indicate the answer is yes, at last. For the past 37 years, United Van Lines has tracked just who's moving where among the 50 states. It's an interesting way to see what states are in demand, which are stable, and which are the ones people want to leave. And for the first time in 16 years, this migration study has some good news for Michigan. Corrigan Moving Systems is a United Van Lines agent in Michigan. Dave Corrigan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
So what did this latest migration study show that was good news in terms of people moving into or out of Michigan?
The great news is in 2013, it's the first time in 16 years that Michigan has been balanced. So we have about the same number of people moving into the state as moving out of the state. And that's just exceptional.
What does it show as far as reasons why Michigan is no longer at the top of that get out of town list?
You know, it's got to be the economy. People come to Michigan because number one, it's a beautiful place to live, but they have to have a good job in order to stay here. Mm. And there's no doubt about it. The auto recovery has been very significant in it, and that's what's highly reported around the country as the reason. But we see it good all through the states. We've got offices, 9 different offices in Michigan. And so on the west side of the state, we got companies like Amway and a lot of others hiring people. In the mid-state, we've got Dow Chemical bringing people in. And also high-tech firms here in Ann Arbor and in Oakland County are hiring people, moving people in. So it's bigger than just the auto companies.
And we know the auto companies and the suppliers are hiring engineers and the like. And I would suspect the fact that I can actually see sold signs now going up on houses. So the housing situation, prices are up, home sales are up. But yet, if you're coming in from elsewhere, we're pretty affordable compared to other parts of the country.
That's very true. It's interesting because not only are we – well, this study measured interstate moves, people mm-hmm. moving from state to state. We handle moves within the state that are not reflected by this survey. But for years, people have been moving out of state. Young college kids get a degree here at our great universities and then move out of state for their jobs.
The brain drain?
I was with a young couple that had just moved to Brighton from here in Michigan, and they had offers. He just graduated from Michigan State University with an MBA, had offers to live in California, to live in Arizona, but he chose to work for the Ford Motor Company and to move to Brighton and to live right here. So that is not reflected in the survey, but my personal experience shows that there's a lot more college students staying than leaving.
I'm curious, Dave. The outbound list is where you don't want to be. So who has taken Michigan's old spot at that top of the outbound states?
This past year, it was New Jersey that had the most people leaving the state as a percentage of the people coming into the state, followed by Illinois and New York. So there's a lot of states in that northern corridor that are losing people.
Dave Corrigan of Corrigan Moving Systems, thanks so much for speaking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Detroit's bankruptcy story has unfolded, a lot of attention has been focused on the Detroit Institute of Arts and its struggle to keep pieces of its collection safe from being sold to satisfy Detroit's creditors. Sitting on the sideline through all of this is another of Detroit's cultural gems, rather overlooked and less loved than the DIA. I'm speaking about the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History. It's the largest museum in the nation devoted to African-American history. And if it doesn't get some help and some love from the public, we could lose it. Detroit Free Press columnist Rochelle Riley joins us now. Hi, Rochelle.
Hello.
It is very, very clear you believe this museum should be mattering not only to people who live in Detroit, but throughout Michigan. But yet the Wright Museum has not gotten a fraction of the attention paid to the DIA. So not to take anything away from the DIA, but why do you think this is?
Well, I think part of it is the DIA has a very strong fan base. You've got a lot of people who are very loud, very vocal, and also spoke with their checkbooks when they were concerned that the DIA, which is one of the best museums, art museums in the country, might have to sell art to help deal with the city's bankruptcy. And, of course, if you sell one piece of art from a museum, no one will ever give a piece of art to that museum again. So you've got built-in patrons. Mm-hmm. The Wright is different. This is a museum that is used by people of all colors to learn and understand a really horrific part of American history. So it's not necessarily the place where people flock to be entertained or to look at a Picasso. It's a place where they go to really reflect and learn and understand. And then there are numerous programs that they have year-round. It's almost a place for people who really care about American history, how we get along with each other, and why we necessarily don't get along with each other, and how we can make things better. And that's not as fun. You know, it's like comparing an amusement park to a doctor's office.
Mm-hmm.
Where
mm-hmm.
you still need it, but you're getting something that helps your health instead of something just to smile about. And I think that's a part of it. It's also become this huge community, I mean, iconic community place for everything from weddings and cultural events to when Rosa Parks, you know, died. She lay in state at the Charles Wright.
So did Coleman Young, I believe.
I'm telling you, this is that place. And I don't think people think about it because they're so used to it being there, it just never dawned on anybody that they could lose it. I've talked to people across the region of all colors who were stunned, and it's used by people across the region. So my hope is that we care as much about our culture and history as we do about our art and history, and that we know that both are necessary, both should be there.
But Rochelle, to those who say, well, it's nice to have the right museum there, but I'd rather have more police cars or more EMS units or streetlights at work or buses that come regularly, does it have to be a one or the other choice, or can the museum stay alive even as other problems in Detroit are being tackled?
Well, you know, I've had people ask, why is there so much attention paid to an art museum when they need those same things? And I try to explain to folks who don't quite make the connection. If you don't create a city that has all these amazing things, so you have all these taxpayers who want to live there, the ones who are living there now, you want to stay there, and the ones who aren't there, you want to move there so that you build your tax base, it's those tax dollars that pay for those necessities. If you don't have the amenities and the things that make a city a great place to be, you're not going to get the population base you need to buy lights and to buy police cars and to do all those other things. So there's not somebody who's sitting around wanting to write a check for police cars. That's a shame, but that's the way it is. That's mm-hmm. real life. What you do is you build an amazing city that becomes the place where everybody wants to be. Their tax dollars go into the pool, and you never have dark streets.
Tell us about Dr. Charles Wright and his dream.
You know, this is the most amazing thing. Here's this obstetrician who literally delivered, he's probably delivered more babies than any obstetrician in the history of Detroit. We don't have the numbers, but I can't tell you how many times I get messages from people saying, he delivered me.
Yeah.
And it's like Freuders from across the country. And what concerned him was that he met a lot of these kids, and they didn't know anything about their history. They didn't understand, you know, I mean, a lot of this was not taught in the public schools, so they didn't know that. So he started trying to individually teach them. And then he decided to open this museum, and he created a little mobile museum that he would take to the neighborhoods of his patients and go around and show them this stuff that was a part of who they were and who their ancestors were. And that's when he decided, you know, we need to have something bigger and lasting so that children of all colors and ages and their families will know about all of this stuff. So he single-handedly got this started, but he had a lot of help and a lot of support. And once they actually got the idea for this big museum, there were fights about where it should be. Well, some folks wanted it connected to the DIA, which, of course, might have made it easier to raise money, but it would be attaching a history museum to an art museum.
Mm-hmm.
He fought to have something separate. Coleman Young helped him, Mayor Coleman Young, the late Mayor Coleman Young, helped him do that. And he didn't want government money initially. He said, don't ask for federal funds. He met with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, well, let me approach the Kennedys. He said, no, I don't want government funding. I want this museum to be built by and for people who believe in this history, you know, Detroiters, African-Americans, and people who understand that African-American history is American history. So he didn't accept any government funds until Coleman Young said, well, it's Detroit, and you should treat Detroit separately and let us help do it. So they did that, and that's how they got connected to the city in the first place. But when you think about the fact that they're talking $1 million or $2 million out of literally the hundreds of millions that are spent in Detroit, it seems like a small thing for a city to fight for, but I'd almost rather that they not want that. I mean, this is one of the places everybody else is trying to get disconnected from the city. The DIA wants to be a separate entity. Belle Isle is now a state park, although it's still owned by the city.
Right.
I understand that they want to be connected to the city, but I almost want them to be a separate entity like everybody else, so people aren't so depending on the city for these things that must last.
Your closing words in your column really struck me. You wrote, every moment spent lifting up things that are worthy takes us far from those moments that were so embarrassing. Talk a little more about that.
You know, Detroit has gone through such a horrific period of embarrassment and, quite frankly, concern-raising behavior that would make people either not want to invest or not want to live here or not want to move a business here. We're already past that. There are people circling Detroit and wanting to be here, be a part of this renaissance like you wouldn't believe. So every single thing we do to push forward and make sure people know that this is not the old Detroit, this is not the place where the mayor is doing things that will get him sent to prison for 28 years. We are in a new place. Everything that happens that reminds people of that is bad for the entire state. And everything that we do that's positive and is great for the city lets people know that we're in a different place. So we got to keep moving forward. There's no time for any steps back at all. And that's what it would be to lose the right, a step back.
Rochelle Riley, Detroit Free Press columnist. As always, thank you so much, Rochelle.
Thank you.
One of the most compelling Michigan stories to emerge from the Sochi Winter Olympics has been ice dance. 15 of the 24 teams train in three Metro Detroit facilities, and that includes Arctic Edge in Canton. Sunday's short program left two of those teams at the head of the pack, Canada's Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer, and for the USA, Charlie Davis and Merrill White. Both teams train at Arctic Edge. Both share the same coach. Today, the two competed for gold. And here comes the spoiler alert, so turn this down just for a moment if you don't want to know what happened today in Sochi. All right, they did it. Charlie Davis and Merrill White won the gold today in the Olympics. They've become the first American team to ever win Olympic gold in ice dance. Davis and White sat down to talk with me last spring as they prepared for the World Figure Skating Championships. I asked the two to describe just what the secret is to the astounding success of Southeast Michigan skaters.
You know, we've imported some fantastic Russian coaching to the area, and then, you know, there's just a lot of great kids with good work ethics. And so, you know, when you put the two together, you get a lot of success, and it's been a lot of fun for us to be able to celebrate that with our, you know, compatriots from Michigan.
And it's quite amazing just somehow this corner of Southeast Michigan drew these Russian coaches and drew such talent, both of you being homegrown, so you did not come in from elsewhere. But Merrill, I guess as you watch this all happening, when you were starting on the ice as a little five-year-old, who'd have figured, huh?
Yeah, exactly. We're very honored and pleased to be here. It seems to have come so quickly.
Describe for us what a typical day is for both of you as far as training, studying, classes, all of the above.
Yeah, so we usually train the first two-thirds of the day, it feels like. We're up pretty early and start on the ice around 7, 8, 9 at the latest. And, you know, we're on the ice for about 4 or 5 hours a day. And, you know, we have a few breaks in there, but we really, you got to leave it all out on the ice every day for practice. And, you know, that's what we try to do. So, you know, 3 days out of the week, we then work out for about an hour and a half. 2 days out of the week, we do ballet. And then we get a chance to go to school. And, you know, it's a great way to actually unwind from the athletic side. And obviously, it's more than a distraction. It's something that we love doing. And, you know, there's a reason why, even though we put ourselves through so much and athletically, we continue with our education. That's just because we love it so much.
When we're looking at a program that you do, like that 2.5 minutes, how much time, Merrill, goes in to that program? I guess I'm asking, how many times might you have done that before it's really the big moment?
Thousands and thousands. Yeah, we rehearse daily, like Charlie said, for probably about 5 hours a day, 5 days a week. And so the time really is important to kind of the perfection that's required for that kind of performance. But I think Charlie and I thoroughly enjoy not only the competition aspect, but the practice aspect as well. We really enjoy kind of seeing our own growth and working really hard. So it's an enjoyable process for us.
How much time now do you see each other off of the ice?
When we're at competitions or, you know, shows, you know, we end up staying together a lot, you know, depending on the situation. And obviously we've been skating together for 15 years, so we've proven that we can put up with one another really well. But, you know, on a day-to-day, like, we don't really hang out after we're done training. I think we just go home and, you know, like I said before, we try to unwind and rest a bit. And so we just so we can come in the next day and be super fresh.
I'm curious, when I was thinking of all the accolades that were pouring down on you and, you know, you were the big stars as you won your fifth national, is it easy to flip that off and come back and just kind of hang around campus and hang around with your friends and just be those folks again?
For us, it absolutely is. You know, I think it's different for everyone, but Charlie and I have been so fortunate to, as you said, grow up in Michigan, spend our whole lives here, have our families, and kind of the same friends our whole lives. And so when we come home, really nothing has changed. And it is a drastic contrast to come from the U.S. National Championships where, you know, at this point in our career, we're walking down the hall and most people know who we are. And then we come home, we walk around campus and more than likely,
nobody
very
with
few
some
people
anonymity.
Know who we are.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
That was Merrill Davis and Charlie White. They joined me in studio last February before the World Figure Skating Championships in London, Ontario. I asked the couple to tell us about the input they have in developing their dance program.
Well, actually, a lot of input does come from our coach. Our main coach, Marina Zueva, is incredibly talented. You know, Charlie and I have been working with her for years, and we're still kind of in awe of her genius. And so I think we like to kind of utilize that to the best of our abilities. But I think now that we've matured and, you know, we're in our 20s, we have a little bit more say than we once did. When we were younger, it was all up to the coaching. But now we like to kind of push the music choices and the choreography in a certain direction.
After winning that fifth title, I was kind of just looking at articles about you. And, you know, let's be honest, sports writers are like falling over themselves trying to find out new ways to say that you two are the greatest U.S. ice dancers of all time. Now, does talk like that help or hurt your mindset?
You know, we try not to pay too much attention to the media or kind of responses to competitions. I think that we have such a great coaching team and so many wonderful, experienced people around us that we try really to focus on that. Certainly, we read a lot of the articles, you know, the Detroit Free Press articles. But I think that we know where we want to go and how we want to get there. So, you know, catching an article every now and then really doesn't deter us from that vision.
But on the other hand, I would imagine to be a national champion or world champion, don't you need a little bit of swagger and maybe a little bit of we are the best arrogance? Because I'm sure this is no place for a shrinking violet to step up there.
No, I mean, it definitely takes nerves of steel. And I don't think the term swag or swagger is used much in ice dance.
Yes.
But I think we definitely have a lot of confidence. And that comes from years of skating together and performing at the top level and knowing what to expect from one another. And also, you know, our training regimen, we do everything we can to prepare ourselves for that moment. So we don't have to worry when we step out on the ice, like, oh, am I going to be ready for this? We go out there and we can almost relax and sort of let our bodies take over.
You know, I have to say, on behalf of the hockey moms and the skating moms and the Irish dance moms, I was one of those, track and field moms and dance moms, got to say, I love the shout out that you gave on your website to both of your moms, understanding the years of kind of nurturing you, especially since you started when you were so tiny. So here's a question that I bet a lot of moms of competing kids would like to ask. Did they have to twist your arms to get you to practice at any point, or were you kind of always had that little bit, oh, Charlie, you're like...
No, they didn't.
They didn't?
You know, Charlie and I are thorough believers in the idea that if you want it badly enough, you can make it happen, but you have to make it happen yourself. And that's not to say that Charlie and I didn't have an extreme amount of support from our families. Mm-hmm. But we've both been very driven, hardworking kids since the beginning. And, you know, if anything, our parents made it quite clear that, you know, you don't have to wake up at 5 a.m. You can sleep in. You can go to soccer practice if you want. And this is what we've really always wanted. And our parents have found the perfect balance between encouraging us but not pushing us too much.
And I think that's something a lot of parents are kind of looking for, that key. Mm-hmm. How much do you push? How much do you go back? And then how do you wipe up tears if things don't go well?
Right.
And I'm sure they had to do that as well. You know, you both started at age 5, and I'm sure as you're at the rink when you're there in Canton and you see the little ones on the rink today who look up to you and hope to be you someday, where do you think your sport will be when they're your age?
Wow, that's a good question. It's probably not something we think about so much. You know, we tend to really just worry about what we're doing in the moment. Mm-hmm. But I think that the U.S. has a very exciting future in ice dance. You know, it's just been growing exponentially. And, you know, just watching the younger couples, even junior novice coming up, we have a lot of talent. And then when you see the juvenile kids who are just insanely talented to be so little, it just almost doesn't even make sense. And it's just so much fun to watch and just fun to know that we have you know, these great skaters coming up.
And I've got to imagine technically the bar is getting raised more and more every year. When you think of what you're doing today and what's accepted versus, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, I would suspect you kind of wonder where is it going to end as far as the technical challenges.
Yeah, there's been quite a drastic change in the last two Olympic cycles, I think, specifically. Mm-hmm. Because of the change in the judging system that happened after the 2002 Olympics, the sport, I think, has taken more of a drastic change and had a lot more growth than possibly in other, you know, another two Olympic cycles. So it's really a very exciting time, I think, to be an ice dancer in particular.
That was Merrill Davis and Charlie White, University of Michigan students who have cemented their reputation as the greatest American ice dancing team ever. Our conversation was recorded in February of 2013. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Latest figures from the government tell us nearly 3.3 million Americans have managed to sign up so far for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And officials are pointing to a surge in young people who are enrolling. The percentage of people aged 18 to 34 who enrolled grew by 3 percentage points last month over the previous 3 months. Attracting healthy young people to sign up is crucial to the success of the ACA. They offset the costs of covering the older folks who are likely less healthy. So what is the key to getting young Americans into the Obamacare tent? My next two guests are focused on that very challenge. Dizzy Warren is here. She's the project director for Enroll Michigan. Very good to have you with us, Dizzy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Eve Ripp. Eve is the Midwest director for the Young Invincibles. Hello, Eve.
Hi, Cynthia. Thank you for having me here today.
So the very name of your group, the Young Invincibles, seems to indicate why it might be a heavier push to get those 18 to 35-year-olds thinking about buying health insurance, because I bet it's easy to think, well, I'm 24, I've got school loans to pay, I can worry about health insurance when I get older. Is that what you find?
You know, what we found is that actually what concerns young adults is cost. In a recent survey, it turns out that just 5% of young adults choose voluntarily not to have insurance. For the other 95%, the principal concern is financial. Young adults know that they're not invincible and know that there is a chance that they could get hurt, could end up in the hospital at any moment.
And does Enroll Michigan has this network of ACA navigators who are helping Michigan consumers kind of sort through the more than 40 plans on the exchange. So what are your people, what are your team hearing from the younger folks?
Well, the same thing that has been done in every age group in the country, and that is making sure that people are even aware what those benefits are and that there could be some financial assistance to them if they enroll.
Once that's made clear, then mm-hmm. do you find, oh, okay, the light goes on, I do want to enroll?
Yes, and I think as you read the latest data, one of the reasons that there's been that 3% increase, in fact, young adults are the leading in the month of January. They enrolled at a greater rate than every other population group. One of the reasons is that groups like Enroll Michigan and our Navigator Network, we've spent a great deal of time out in the field explaining to people what's in it for them. And for young adults, and especially young women, it could include things like free contraceptive care, which is, again, a cost-related factor. Mm-hmm. It includes things like mammograms, you know, be it free mammograms, so to speak. No out-of-pocket costs related to that. It includes things like domestic violence counseling. All of these are new benefits for women in general and young women specifically, especially as we looked at things like contraceptive care and breastfeeding equipment.
Tell us a little about what the Young Invincibles does, Eve.
Absolutely. So Young Invincibles is focused on expanding economic opportunity for 18 to 34-year-olds. We're a nationwide nonprofit, and access to health care is a big part of what we do. In recent months, we've been running the Healthy Young America campaign, targeted at educating and enrolling as many young adults as possible. We have a mobile app, our Healthy Young America app, which provides information for young adults and a corresponding website where young adults can go online, get some frequently asked questions answered, learn more about health providers in their area, use a cost calculator. Basically, it just makes learning more about health insurance really accessible and friendly to young adults.
If you just joined us, I'm speaking with Eve Ripp. She's the Midwest Director for the Young Invincibles, and she's joined by Dizzy Warren. Dizzy's the Project Director for Enroll Michigan, and that team of navigators has been working so hard since October 1st, trying to get people into that Obamacare tent. And do you think that the troubles with the rollout, now that they're over and done with, does that free you up to be able to kind of focus on the benefits and also reminding people of this impending March 31st deadline?
Well, as navigators, we have to do a lot of things all at once. So the outreach, letting folks know, reaching out to those that are insured. The education, letting them know what benefits are there and the fact that they more than likely might be eligible for some financial assistance. And then finally, the enrollment component. So even when the website wasn't working as effective as it is today, we never stop enrolling people because the website is only a door to enrollment. It is not the Affordable Care Act. And so we've been doing all three of those all along. And so today, if you look on our website, you'll find in the state of Michigan literally hundreds of opportunities for young adults and anyone in general where they can go somewhere in their neighborhood or their community and get some help, get an enrolled.
And is there a need to tailor the message differently for, let's say, a 25 or 30-year-old than you would to a 60-year-old?
Definitely. The needs are very different. And that's one of the good things about the Affordable Care Act and the opportunity to get enrolled is that you are looking for what benefits you and your family. And so for every person that's looking for something different, we've had some really great stories of where a family would come in. Mm-hmm. And as it turns out, because of an age difference, like one is 60 and the other one may have had a pre-existing condition, that they may need completely different in coverages. And so we've been able to, by talking to them, finding out what their needs, customizes their help them to select a customized plan for their specific need.
So, I've noticed commercials. Healthcare.gov has been running a lot of commercials where I see a lot of young people doing young people things. And then also we know that there was a campaign that was launched by Enroll America using singing and rapping pets.
Right.
And the idea being?
You have to appeal to all populations. This is not a one-size-fits-all program. In fact, that's the best thing about it. And so, yes, there's different ways of appealing. And there's the you have to appeal to people culturally as well. So the message I might bring to that faith-based congregation in urban Detroit might be completely different than the one that I would bring to the a different group in a different type of environment, such as a rural environment.
Sure.
So,
Eve, I'm curious, as you work at Young Invincibles, do you think, is it really the women who are the key to signing up for health coverage?
Well, you know, we've seen that young men are uninsured at slightly higher rates than young women, certainly. But what we've also found is that ads targeted at mothers and at girlfriends have been incredibly effective at helping young men to enroll. Sometimes getting just a little bit of pressure from a woman in your life has been very helpful for the young uninsured men.
I would completely agree with that. We have a story from Detroit. A young man forced to come to see at one of our navigators because the navigator was his friend with his mom. So she forced him to go and talk to her. He was uninsured, as a lot of young adults are. And he not only got coverage, because his reason for not going on his own is he thought he couldn't afford anything. And so he not only got coverage, but in his expense, because of the cost-sharing component, it was 17 cents a month. So he's been one of our biggest champions in the Detroit area talking to young adults. Since then, that navigator has signed up five other young adults because of him telling them, go talk to them. There may be something there for you.
Because the wallet speaks. The other thing that I think it's worth reminding everyone, and I'll let you take this one, Dizzy, is the March 31st deadline and why people need to keep their eye on that looming deadline.
Well, if you are the only place that you can get financial assistance to help you cover your premium is through the marketplace. Well, that open enrollment period as it relates to the marketplace is over essentially March 31st. So you need to get signed up now as soon as possible. But then there's those who, for example, those are Medicaid eligible. That open enrollment period is ongoing, so we need to make the distinction between those who would be eligible for the services under the marketplace that closes versus those who will be eligible to sign up on an ongoing basis.
And it's important for the public to realize if you haven't signed up by March 31st, you would have to pay that penalty of either $95.
You might be subject to a penalty. Not everyone will, whether you sign up or not, because there are some, for example, religious
sure.
concerns, you may not be charged. Or if your income is so low, mm-hmm. you won't be charged. So there are few exceptions, but the idea is, why continue to go uninsured yeah. when you can get insurance coverage now?
Yeah, and you don't want an ugly surprise when you go to file your
exactly.
taxes in 2015.
Yes.
And, you know, we've found that for 60% of young adults, they're able to get plans for under $100 a month.
Yes.
So when you can get insurance that's that affordable, paying the penalty starts to seem, you know, really, really ridiculous.
Exactly.
What do you find as you work with the Young Invincibles, Eve, is the most satisfying part of your work of bringing these young people on board?
Well, you know, so many of the young adults that we work with have just no idea how affordable coverage can be for them. We've been able to get coverage for young adults for, you know, $5, $10 a month. And just seeing how excited young adults often are to learn that insurance really is within their pocketbook has been tremendously exciting.
And I would add to it, the other good thing about it, it's not that they're signing up for the lowest coverage either. Most young adults, as well as others, are signing up for the Silver Plan, which seems to cover the needs of most people. So mm-hmm. young adults not only can get cheaper insurance than they think, they can also get much better coverage than they ever dreamed.
So do you think you're going to be on track for meeting the quotas? And I know that there was the hope that overall we'd see 7 million Americans. That was the kind of stated goal. We're at 3.3 now. Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to hit that goal?
I think we are. In the state of Michigan, we've already met the first goal mm-hmm. In terms of number of folks we wanted to be insured by this time. And so I think we'll definitely reach it. We're ramping up all over the state, March 31st, marching toward that deadline.
And to build on that, what we've seen coming out of Massachusetts is that young adults did wait until that deadline. Young adults mm-hmm. are often procrastinators mm-hmm. And don't feel the urgent need to get insurance as much as older adults might. So you do see a big surge in the numbers going on right as we approach the deadline.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, the work goes on. Dizzy Warren, Project Director of Enroll Michigan, working with that team of navigators, getting people on board. And Eve Ripp, who's the Midwest Director for the Young Invincibles. Good to talk to both of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
For having us here today.
You think solar power and solar panels, and what comes to mind? Well, right, the sun. So what are the prospects for solar power in areas that tend to be cloudy, intensely snowy, and very cold, with short days and long nights? Areas like the Upper Peninsula. Sam Eggleston writes for the Upper Peninsula Second Wave, and he joins us now from snowy Marquette. Hello, Sam.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. So give us an idea. How much snow do you have on the ground right now in Marquette as we speak?
Well, last check, we had 41 inches, but we're expecting 6 more tonight. So
so you could be pushing 50 in no time at all. And temperature, what's a typical, you know, especially with this polar vortex going on, typical kind of temperatures?
The polar vortex has not been our friend. The typical temperatures have been below zero. We actually set a record for the most below 0 days in a row. So everybody's on must-run water right now because it's even freezing in the city streets. So we got to keep the water running.
Well, you wrote a piece that asks a very good question. Does solar power work in the Upper Peninsula?
That's
and
right.
Solar panels absorb heat and light from the sun. So can the UP's winter climate support this?
Actually, it can, and quite well. The colder that the temperatures are, the more that the sun is effective on these panels because it forces them the molecules inside to move more, thus creating more energy. The problem for us, though, is how much sunlight we actually get. So there's been a lot of study on ways to make improvements on you know the amount of sun that these panels are getting, the daylight, you know, how we can best take advantage of our short days.
And you took a look at some of the work that the engineers at Michigan Tech are doing to kind of tackle this question. How are they testing this and working this out?
You know, what they're doing, it's actually a real ingenious. They've taken multiple panels and they're aiming them at different angles to see what's giving us the best reflection off the snow and what's keeping snow off the panels in order to you know allow that sunlight to get in there. And they're finding that you know certain degrees in terms of angles are great. You know, 60 degrees, that's excellent for keeping snow off, but we're not getting much sunlight. So it's a two-year program where they're just going to continue to study these effects, see how well the reflection off snow is going to do the same job as direct sunlight. And so that's the focus right now on that, on the whole program that they've got going up at in Houghton right now. So,
and it strikes me that there has to be interest from all over the world as to what they're doing, because I'm sure folks who are, homes and businesses who are in these climates like the UP are watching and saying, hey, it shouldn't all just be Arizona and Mexico and warm places that can take advantage of solar power.
Exactly. Take, for example, Colorado. They've been really interested in solar power, but in the higher elevations, they get snow like we do. And so, they've been really watching us, because there's a lot of push for alternative energy there, and we're seeing a lot more of that in the middle part of our country, where the power lines are real far and there's a lot of open land. So, these northern states are really watching these tests that are going on. And there's similar ones in Alaska, but not quite as extensive as happening in Houghton right now. And, hoping to see that, yes, that we can do this, and yes, it does make an actual impact for these businesses, for these, people who want to be off the grid a little bit more. And, so the attention that it's getting is really positive. We're seeing companies from other countries helping out. We're seeing Michigan Tech alumni who've moved on to Texas, and they have their own solar powered businesses. They're donating items to make sure that all of this gets tested thoroughly, and so that everyone can take advantage of it in the near future.
And it sounds like the push is not only to be able to get energy from these solar panels, but also to make it reasonable as far as the cost.
Right. Yeah. One of the nice things about Michigan Tech is the just number of outstanding minds that they have there in terms of engineering students. And so these students are focused really heavily with their projects on trying to find, these panels that can be created from different materials that do the same job in this type of climate, that handle this type of climate just fine, but do it at a reduced cost. And that would really boost interest in the northern climates, especially on the private homeowner or the private business, in terms of putting up this type of device, where right now maybe they hesitate because they're made to survive in the desert. They're not necessarily made to survive in December in the Upper Peninsula. So,
in the meantime, those of you who are living with your nearly 50 inches of snow are looking at us as we whine over getting 6 inches, and you're probably snickering a little, aren't you?
Well, we kind of laugh a little bit, but at the same time, we feel sorry for you. We know how it is to hit the road when it's not quite plowed right, and we're usually prepared for it. You, not so much.
Sam Eggleston, the managing editor of the Upper Peninsula Second Wave. Good talking with you, Sam. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.